From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Fewer people are getting vaccinated in recent days. The 7-day average of COVID-19 shots administered in the U.S. has dropped to under 2 million a day for the first time since March. And some states are even turning down doses. To put this into context, only about a third of the country is fully vaccinated. That's far below what's needed for widespread herd immunity. And there's also other news about the vaccine. Pfizer is asking the FDA for full approval of its vaccine. This is a shift from emergency authorization, and it has important national implications. Let's bring in Dr. Ashish Jha. He's dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, an expert in global health policy. And Dr. Jha, welcome back, and let's start with the Pfizer's request for full authorization. How important is that shift?
So on one hand, you could say, well, it won't make a huge difference on a day-to-day functional basis. People can get their Pfizer shot now. They will be able to get it after the full approval. But I actually think symbolically it's very important because for some proportion of people, the fact that the vaccines have been issued under emergency use authorization, you know, gives them a little bit of hesitation on whether to get it or not. And this really will, the full approval will make a big difference in helping people feel much more confident about the vaccine. It'll help businesses feel more confident about mandating vaccines. I think it will end up making a big difference.
On the subject of businesses, the shot would allow, as you said, businesses and public establishments to mandate the shot. Why is that? And do you anticipate more of that going forward?
Yeah, you know, I've been talking to a lot of businesses. I think they're thinking about it and many of them are leaning towards it. And the reason they're thinking about it is because people want to create a safe work environment. And if you want to be able to bring people back safely into your office, and if you don't want to require that everybody be masked up all the time and socially distanced all the time, and for, you know, forever going forward, then the best way to really ensure safety is to make sure that everybody's vaccinated. And companies get that, and they feel a certain sense of obligation to protect their workers. They're on the fence, and the full approval may help them jump off that fence and go ahead and do that mandate.
There is some worry, however, that this approval could prevent other vaccine makers from being able to get emergency authorizations for their vaccines, since emergency use is generally enacted when there are no other options. Doctor, is that problematic?
I don't think that's going to happen because, of course, part of what's happening is that we're still in a public health emergency. We're not done yet. And so I think the FDA will look at each individual new application in that light. Now, there is a question of, you know, how many more new vaccines do we need in the United States? There are several that are potentially coming online, Novavax, AstraZeneca. But right now we have such a glut of vaccines. We have so much vaccines across America. Even if it ends up being a hindrance, it's not going to really affect Americans in any meaningful way.
How long do you think this authorization will take, assuming it's approved?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. I mean, under normal circumstances, these things can take many, many months. Of course, we're not under normal circumstances. So I think the FDA is going to feel some pressure to try to do this, ideally in the next month or 6 weeks.
Okay. Doctor, let's turn to some other vaccine news. There was this study published in the New England Journal of Medicine that shows current vaccines are very effective against some very worrying variants, including the first one found in South Africa. How significant is this?
Oh, it's really both very significant and terrific, terrific news. The thing that people need to understand is that these variants are a problem. I think it'd be unfair to suggest otherwise. And some of them do cause breakthrough infections, even if you're vaccinated. But these are remarkable vaccines. They hold up in terms of preventing severe illness. So even if you're unfortunate enough to have one of those breakthrough infections, you're extremely unlikely to get very sick, get hospitalized, or die from this.
There's this other study that points, though, to the importance of herd immunity. And of course, we've been talking a lot about this over the last few days. But a team at Johns Hopkins found that fewer than half of organ transplant patients who received two doses of vaccine produced any antibodies at all. And if they did, the amount was much smaller than people with stronger immune systems. This is kind of devastating news for people with suppressed immune systems. What does this mean in terms of public health?
Yeah, it's a really important study, and it's a really important point. There are always going to be those among us in our population who are immunocompromised, who are not going to have the same immune response. And one of the reasons we've got to get as many people vaccinated as possible and build up population-level immunity to very, very high level is that it not just protects individuals who got vaccinated, but it protects those among us who do have compromised immune systems. There are many, many reasons to get vaccinated. It's not just about you. And my hope is that over time, as more Americans become comfortable getting vaccinated, we will be able to get to 80, 90% vaccinations. I'm actually pretty confident that we will. It's going to be work, but part of it is going to be about appealing to people's, you know, sense of duty, not just to themselves, but to their fellow Americans.
On the same token, Doctor, we're still seeing super spreader events, including there was one just recently in Oregon where a church that sued over restrictions created a super spreader event in recent weeks. So far, at least 74 people infected. What is your takeaway there?
We're not done with this pandemic. And actually, at this moment, it is riskier than ever to be unvaccinated because you have these pretty contagious strains that are circulating at high levels. And they're circulating among unvaccinated people. So we are going to see super spreader events like that among unvaccinated people. But my hope is that it reminds people that the virus isn't going to be gone. People need to get vaccinated and continue to do some basic public health things to get us through what I think will be this transition period before we're at a much, much better place as we get into the summer and fall.
It's Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of the Brown University Public Health School. Doctor, as always, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back.
Well, with more people getting vaccinated, the performing arts are coming back. New York's Lincoln Center has been dark since March of 2020, but tonight audiences will get the chance to return to a radically transformed physical space. As we hear from NPR's Jeff London, it's designed for safety, but the space is also more inviting and inclusive.
Before the pandemic shut everything down, Lincoln Center attracted 6 million visitors a year. Henry Timms, Lincoln Center's president, says he particularly misses seeing thousands of people crossing the Central Plaza.
One of my favorite times at Lincoln Center actually is just before curtain comes up. And just after it comes down on campus. And you just have this moment where the campus is completely full of people. And one of the many, many things we miss at Lincoln Center is that feeling of community, that sense of connection.
So to bring the community back to Lincoln Center, the Performing Arts Complex is creating something called Restart Stages.
Could we create an outdoor performing arts center, a temporary performing arts center, just for this spring and this summer, to then help organizations at Lincoln Center and across the city start rehearsing again, start performing again, and to give our audiences a kind of safe on-ramp to coming back to the arts.
10 stages are being built on the 16-acre campus for performances and rehearsals, as well as high school graduations and blood drives. But the biggest transformation will be of the Central Plaza, in front of the marble-clad homes of the Metropolitan Opera, New York City Ballet, and New York Philharmonic, made famous in movies like Moonstruck.
One of the things that I have noticed when working here at the theaters is that there is nowhere to sit on this plaza.
Mimi Lien is a Tony and MacArthur winning set designer who is creating a kind of village green. While she had hoped to cover the plaza with real grass, it proved impractical. So she's using an environmentally responsible artificial turf. Most of the surface is flat, but there's a slope on each side of the plaza. It looks like a half pipe that people can sit on.
Yesterday, when I was here testing out the slope, I was overtaken by the childhood urge to just roll down the slope.
Leanne hopes that people will hang out in the plaza.
Get a coffee and some food at the cafe, sit in a chair or on the grass, check out a book from the library corner, perhaps take in a pop-up performance. I would love for it to be a multifaceted civic space.
And that's what Lincoln Center is aiming for, appealing not just to the people who can afford $300 to go to the opera, but to those who just want to spend some time outside and perhaps catch a performance of a group not usually seen on one of the main stages, such as the Korean Cultural Alliance or Harlem Week or the Red Hawk Native Arts Council. That company's director, Cliff Mattias, says members of the Ramapo Lenape will open Restart Stages with a land acknowledgement and...
We're going to share a mixture of indigenous performances from across the hemisphere. And, you know, we always just do live music and drumming and singing and rattle songs as well. Just an opportunity to come and share and celebrate after such a long time.
Lincoln Center President Henry Timms says the enforced pause with both COVID and calls for social justice has made the people running Lincoln Center and other arts organizations around the country question their core mission.
We never wanted this period to be a period where we would just pause and then come back as the same organization who we were. How is it we are coming back differently? Who's on our stages and how are we engaging with broader communities and what are we saying to the world? All those questions are obviously critical.
Restart Stages begins tonight. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Police in Colombia continue their violent crackdown on protests that have swept the country since last month. Dozens have died in the unrest, which began in response to a tax proposal, but has come to embody the country's despair over COVID-19, poverty, and injustice. John Otis reports for NPR from Colombia, and he joins us now with the latest. And John, protesters have blocked roads and attacked police stations, and police have responded with what the United Nations Human Rights Office has actually called excessive force. Where does the protest movement stand today?
We're about 2 weeks into this, and it shows no sign of letting up. And what happened is, as you mentioned, there was a lot of police violence, a big police crackdown against the protesters. And just in the first couple of days, two dozen people were killed. And, you know, more than 100 people are missing right now. And so that's just sort of caused even more protests. It's kind of a snowball effect. People are now out there protesting because they're angry about police violence. And so it's sort of hard to see how this is going to come to an end.
Two dozen people killed and 100 or more than 100 people missing. Can you give us a sense of who these folks are who are participating in these protests? And it's become a national movement.
That's right. It's not, you know, a lot of times protests just happen here in Bogota, the capital, but this one is a little different because it's a nationwide protest. They're calling it a national strike. And in terms of the people who are participating, I've met retirees. There are students who say, you know, they've had to drop out of school during the pandemic. There's indigenous groups who are protesting. There's been a fair amount of violence as well, a lot of it coming from the police side, but there have also been a lot of vandalism, looting and burning and destroying bus stations. So the government is sort of trying to crack down on that, and they're trying to paint the protest movement as sort of a criminal movement, and that's causing even more anger among the protesters.
Well, is the government making any concessions at all?
Well, they have backed down on their proposed tax hike. But that's really about it so far. Only today is the government sitting down with the leaders of the protest movement to try to figure out where we go from here. But it's a really difficult situation because everything the protesters are asking for is going to require more government spending. And the government's running a big deficit right now in their effort to raise taxes to get more money to pay for some of the things that the protesters want was the thing that started the protests in the first place. So it's difficult to see where this is going to go. The government just doesn't have very much room to maneuver at this point.
Reporter John Otis in Colombia, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you very much.
Well, if you have an idea of what it means to be a father, set it aside for this next conversation. In the new film Together, Together, actor Ed Helms plays Matt, a single man in his 40s who wants to have a child. Enter Anna, a barista played by Patty Harrison, who agrees to be his gestational surrogate. The relationship doesn't begin well. Matt takes Anna to dinner and frets over her order.
I'm sorry, I just was worried when you ordered the potatoes because what you eat, it eats. They eat.
You ordered pasta with bacon.
Yeah, but I'm the only one eating it.
But I only matter for like the next like 9 months or so, and you matter for the next 18 plus years.
Over the course of Anna's pregnancy, the two come to understand and even love each other, but not in the way you'd think. Together, Together was written and directed by Nicole Beckwith, who joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you. And you know, this surrogate story, I think, is often told from the point of view of the woman who is carrying the baby, which you do hear, but I also think you're trying to tell a different kind of story. Is that right?
Yes, definitely. I think a lot of our surrogacy narratives are a little melancholy and kind of focusing on the conflict of quote unquote giving up the child. I can see how that is dramatically very intriguing, but I also think we need to balance that out. I think surrogacy is additive and is still something that's very stigmatized, and I don't feel as though it should be.
And I do want to ask you about your characters, and specifically Matt. This is the character played by Ed Helms. He's in his late 40s. He's straight. He's got a good job. But clearly, he's missing something in his life. And you do also get the sense that he's very aware of his own biological clock, which is very interesting because a more traditional point of view would say that, you know, that's not something that men ever think about or that affects them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they do. I think that men have a biological clock too. Men have feelings on the subject. I think we're like inundated with stories about parenthood that are very focused on a woman either forging that path by herself or demanding that her reluctant husband follow her into this next stage. And I do think that that is detrimental to the way we perceive these questions and these issues. And part of feminist filmmaking is, of course, deepening and strengthening the representation of women on stage and on screen. But the same is true for men. It is also about deepening and strengthening the representation of men on screen.
Why do you think we've ignored that part of the story for so long? I mean, is it just sort of like hard for people to even grapple with the concept that this might also be an emotional process for men?
I'm not sure. I mean, it confuses me. I think it's like very tethered to like if a father like comes by and picks up their kid from school once, everyone's like, oh my God, what an amazing father. He came and picked them up. And meanwhile, the mom has done it all other 364 days or whatever.
Exactly.
And if she's 5 minutes late, it's like, wow, 5 minutes late again. And so it's very harsh on both, you know, men and women.
To that point, exactly. I want to listen to another scene here. This is where Matt and Anna, they go crib shopping together and the salesperson thinks they're a couple. Let's listen.
I think you two are going to be really happy with this.
Ew, no, we're not together.
Oh.
She's my surrogate.
Oh.
Wait, why is the idea of me being a single mom and the idea of him being a single dad? Oh.
Okay, so I mean, it's kind of funny in the moment there, but it's actually, you make a serious point here. You have a single mother is often sort of met with disapproval in our culture, right? And then there's like the single father is kind of cute or endearing.
I think it's that particular idea, I think, is also kind of tethered to this idea of like men become fathers like reluctantly. And I think that that's I think that's really bad. It does contribute to toxic masculinity, this idea of what manhood is and what it is to be, you know, a man or a father or whoever. And so obviously this scenario between Matt and Anna and their relationship opened the door for a lot of these conversations. I wasn't like, I'm going to tell a story where I get to say these things, but you know, I'm writing the script and they're in the crib store. And then it's just like, oh yeah, well, this is what would happen.
The tone of the film, well, on the one hand, it's like laugh out loud funny sometimes. It's also incredibly uncomfortably awkward at other times, which I think you're probably making us want to feel. On the other hand, you're tackling some of these really big issues, and it's heartfelt and it's dramatic. And you have these two actors, Patty Harrison and Ed Helms, who are known for being funny. Like Ed Helms is, you know, best known for his role in like The Hangover, you know, when he's just sort of like some raunchy dude. But he's clearly a lot more than that in this film.
Well, yeah, when I see Ed's work, I think like even in his most hilarious roles and the biggest comedic moments, I'm always recognizing this core of vulnerability and humanity. And so I wanted Ed for this role because I wanted a chance to see what would happen if that stuff got to be in the front seat and the other stuff was in the backseat. You know, I see that beautiful gift in him, and I wanted to put a light on it. Mm.
You know, one of the things that people are going to notice in this movie is that you have these two characters that we've been talking about, an older man, a younger woman. In any other film, you would expect them to fall in love. And they do in this movie, but not really, again, in the way that you'd expect. Talk about that for a minute, because it's so rare to see platonic love in the movies between a straight man and a straight woman. What's the power of seeing that on film?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think we need to see it. I think we've been conditioned to have those expectations. It probably goes all the way back into time about how men make the decisions. Men have been the gatekeepers for this stuff. They ran all the studios. They directed all the movies. They wrote all the movies. Then a generation of people grew up on those movies, and then they go on to make movies, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's really bad, and it also like reinforces this idea that the most important thing a woman brings into a relationship is something as transient and temporary as her youth or her sex appeal. It's unfortunate to also just assume, age difference or not, I'm looking at two people on screen and they're going to fall in love. And that's what a happy ending is. The relationship between Matt and Anna exists in part because of their age difference, and they do get a lot from each other and communicate that and evolve together. That's great. They don't need to like be getting naked for that to happen. It's important that we start looking at the different ways people love, the different ways people can connect. I would love to watch a movie and like not know what to expect.
Nicole Beckwith, cracking stereotypes and conventions with her new film, Together, Together. Thank you so much for talking to me about it, and thanks for making it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for saying that. Thank you for having me.
Today, it seems like everybody's got a bone to pick with the news. So it happens when somebody stops talking smack and just decides to wage all-out war.
First thing you do in an invasion, you eliminate the communications of the enemy.
And what happens if they win? Visit Stockton, California, for a story about a revolt against the mainstream media that's shaken up a city. From NPR's Invisibilia.
Debris from the Chinese rocket that fell back to Earth over the weekend splashed uneventfully into the Indian Ocean. This kind of thing isn't unheard of. Back in March, a U.S. commercial rocket rained debris onto parts of Washington State. That provided a chance for researchers working on a space junk warning system. The Northwest News Network's Tom Bonsi reports.
People in Jordan and Oman captured fleeting glimpses of the falling Chinese rocket before its remnants crashed into the Indian Ocean. It wasn't as amazing of a light show as stargazers in the Pacific Northwest were unexpectedly treated to 6 weeks ago. That errant re-entry of a spent American rocket sent fireballs streaking high overhead.
Wait, what's going on?
I don't know.
That's more than a comet.
Genevieve Rayom pulled out her cell phone camera in Portland, Oregon.
What is that?
That's insane.
The flaming debris was the upper stage of a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket used to launch commercial satellites. It wasn't supposed to re-enter and break apart over populated land, but it did, and that produced an R&D jackpot for a trio of space junk sleuths.
Yeah, I was extraordinarily pleased with the results of the expedition.
Robert Ward does the on-the-ground scouting for the trio. He's a skilled meteorite hunter from Arizona. Ward spent 3 weeks scouting the back roads and byways of central Washington state in search of rocket pieces.
We were very fortunate that the debris fell in that area. The rolling hills and vineyards and orchards made for very good hunting. If it would have fallen in the forested areas, our ability to recover pieces would have been hindered greatly.
The rocket engine and nozzle are still missing, but Ward found two propellant tanks and he contacted landowners who found the two others. Ward passed along the exact coordinates to his virtual collaborators, Mike Hanke and Ken Howard. Hanke is the operations manager for the American Meteor Society. Howard is a weather radar expert with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Together, they reconstructed the debris fall. The goal is to use this event and others like it to train computers to automatically detect falling space junk and meteors. The system could draw on data from live weather radars, cameras pointed at the sky, and maybe even satellites.
This case is going to be, in essence, foundational to helping us develop a workflow.
Ken Howard, speaking from the NOAA National Severe Storms Lab in Oklahoma.
One of the lessons learned from this particular case is that you can have 1,000 pounds of space debris falling through commercial airspace, and there's no alerts that that's occurring. And that's no fault of any one government agency. It's kind of a service gap.
That's a gap Howard and Hanke are trying to plug, including whether alerts can be delivered fast enough to be useful to pilots or people on the ground. Hanke says timely confirmation that a meteorite or space junk fell out of the sky could have value even if early warning is out of reach right now.
There's value in letting EMS operators know, fire departments, police, that, hey, this happened, so that they don't waste resources on it, looking into it.
Hanke predicts the fireballs over the Pacific Northwest in late March and this weekend's re-entry of the larger Chinese rocket won't be isolated events.
It's definitely going to happen more. There's no question about that.
Given how much space junk is overhead, with more being added at an increasing rate each year. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi.
Let's go to a neighborhood like no other place in the world. 50 city blocks in downtown Los Angeles, known as Skid Row.
It's hot sometimes. It's cold sometimes. People, you know, you have to watch yourself.
This woman, who preferred not to give her name, is one of about 4,600 people who live here. She sits in a lawn chair on the sidewalk with all of her belongings at arm's reach, just outside of the Union Rescue Mission, a nonprofit Christian organization that offers shelter and other services. She's been out here for a year and says she was once a college student. On this day, she wants to make certain she has a place in line for shelter once the sun goes down.
The Midnight, they let people in. The Midnight Mission, they let people in. There's a little sleeping area for, you know, men and women. They keep it segregated.
Finding a place to sleep at night is a race against time. Homeless people like this woman often jockey for space. Some streets in Skid Row are so congested with tents, scattered belongings, and people that it's impossible to drive or walk through. It's also dangerous. Andy Bales, who is the CEO of the Union Rescue Mission, requested a security guard accompany us during our interview. And just as we were getting started, we encountered a person agitated by our presence.
How would...
In front of us right now who's a little revved up.
Bill says this happens just about every day, especially during the pandemic.
Is what we're seeing now the worst of what you've seen?
Absolutely the worst it's ever been. We used to have a front of Union Rescue Mission, and this sidewalk was completely clear. This whole street was completely clear, but now it's rare that you can find a sidewalk that you can pass. It's packed with people devastated by homelessness. A lot of the volunteers and groups that used to bring a lot of aid have ceased. Fentanyl has been mixed with traditional drugs to bring a much higher level of overdose deaths.
Skid Row is an unofficial containment zone in downtown L.A., where for decades, city and private organizations provided shelters and services for homeless people. But the city's attempt to solve the problem by imposing anti-camping ordinances and street sweeps have all but failed, according to federal judge David Carter, who says L.A.'s decades of bad public policy decisions, mental health service failures, and institutional racism have contributed to a disaster that can only be solved by forcing the city's hand. The judge ruled last month in response to a lawsuit filed last year by a group of downtown business owners and community members. The ruling says that LA must provide or offer shelter to Skid Row's unhoused by October 18th. Women and children must be offered housing within 90 days.
Again, Andy Bales.
I'll tell you, that is one of the biggest heartbreaks for me, is seeing beautiful people of color suffer inordinately on these streets of Skid Row. That's why I'm so for the judge's injunction, because it's all based on reversing the wrongs that have been done to people, especially people of color.
The injunction calls for the city to also put $1 billion into an escrow account to help fund this effort. But other than that, the way the city and county should go about it is still not clear. Some housing advocates fear the lack of instructions may lead to an increase in shelters versus long-term solutions like permanent housing. Eric Tarz, legal director of the National Homelessness Law Center, says the judge's ruling is like a doctor getting the diagnosis right, but the prescription wrong.
So we've actually advocated for this kind of an approach for many years, because we do see in case after case, judges are striking down the kinds of ordinances that criminalize people experiencing homelessness. The basic everyday life activities that you and I take for granted. We have to sleep every day. We have to shelter ourselves. And those activities can sometimes be criminalized. And people, even those who don't have any option but to perform those activities in public, are being threatened with fines, fees, and jail time. But what happens too often is we see these ordinances get struck down, and then they reemerge in some other form. So you take away the camping ordinance, and all of a sudden you can't be in the park after dark. You take away the anti-sitting ordinance, and all of a sudden you're loitering. And so we've argued in law review articles, for example, that the only way to actually remedy the continuing constitutional violation in these sorts of cases is by getting to the root of the problem, which is that homelessness exists, and the only way to do that is to actually get people into adequate housing. The judge, the prescribed solution that he has here, is going to make things worse because he's focusing on shelter solutions rather than on housing.
Well, let's break that down a little bit. There are at least a few possible outcomes of how this order in LA will play out. From your point of view, what might happen? What are some of the implications that we could see from it?
Well, so, you know, if the order is upheld in its current state, then the real danger that we see is the city is compelled to offer not housing, but shelter to individuals, which Judge Carter himself has said, well, they are free to refuse that offer. But he gives the green light in his order to resume enforcement of anti-camping ordinances thereafter. And so we see a real danger that this is actually going to create a situation, the exact kind of situation that we were afraid President Trump was trying to create last year when he was working on an executive order that would have, you know, basically rounded people up into internment camps, warehousing them under threat of arrest. And this is essentially the same thing. We hope, obviously, that that doesn't happen. But another outcome could be that this case is on appeal right now to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit could strike down the order on procedural grounds, which would be, you know, a positive outcome, because we don't like the remedy that's issued here, although we do like some of the ruling. And the other option, of course, is that the city and the county and the judge and the plaintiffs and the interveners who are homeless, you know, they could come to a settlement, which hopefully would benefit everybody. And so that's the best outcome, I guess.
In the immediate term, what would you like to see be done?
Shelter. There is a role for shelter for emergency purposes in any homelessness system. But what we're looking to do, and where Judge Carter goes wrong, is he should be turning his eyes to are all of the other housing policies that LA has that have for too long promoted the growth of, you know, high-end housing rather than deeply affordable housing. And those are the policies that need to be shifted. We are looking for solutions at the national level, too. And we are very, very hopeful that this president and this administration have come in with an attitude for the first time since FDR that housing is a human right, and that they are working on policies that are actually going to make it so that that right is enjoyed in practice. And if we can get the universal vouchers and other things that we are hoping to get from some of these, the infrastructure package, the jobs package, the families package, then that's going to be give Los Angeles a lot more resources to be able to make a dent in the housing situation much more quickly. And so, again, the urgency is there, but in this case, a big part of the solution may be right around the corner. And so rushing into something now, it's not the time for that.
Andy Bales with the Union Rescue Mission says he doesn't disagree with Eric Tarr's. Sustainable long-term housing is the ultimate solution. But in the short term, he believes getting people out of dangerous and unsanitary conditions should be the first priority. And if temporary shelters are the way to do that, Bales is ready to see it. Anything, he says, to offer some relief.
If you're on the streets, you never get a chance to rest. I mean, how much do you and I cherish sleep at night? How much do I cherish a nap when I'm exhausted? People who are devastated by homelessness can never get that rest that's needed for you to be a human.
The county of Los Angeles has filed an appeal against the judge's ruling, and we will be following this story as it progresses.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is trying to defuse a potential crisis after parliamentary elections last Thursday gave Scotland's pro-independence party its fourth straight win. Johnson is now inviting the leaders of United Kingdom nations to gather for talks, but the Scottish National Party leader Nicola Sturgeon told the BBC that London should not stand in the way of a second independence referendum.
The fact that we're sitting here having a debate about whether or not that outcome is going to be respected says a lot about the lack of respect for Scottish democracy that this UK government has demonstrated over quite some time now.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson joins us now on Skype. Rob, welcome.
Nice to be with you, Peter. Nice to be with everybody.
Yeah, I mean, can you remind us why we're here again talking about Scottish independence? What exactly happened with these elections?
I thought you were going to say, why are we talking about Scottish independence again after 2014, in which case the answer would be Brexit. But no doubt we'll get back to that in a second, Peter. So the reason we're talking about it is that the fervently pro-independence and pro-EU Scottish National Party is once again the biggest party in the Scottish Parliament, and it's increased its majority. And it had always said it wanted another referendum. And the reason why this whole issue has come back about Scottish independence is because of Brexit, as I suggested. And that's because while England voted by a small majority to leave the European Union, by two-thirds Scottish people voted to remain in the EU. So that has been a sort of source of friction ever since the referendum. And of course, the Scottish National Party, which, as I say, is pro-EU, is not at all happy with the version of Brexit that Boris Johnson has come up with.
Boris Johnson and Nicola Sturgeon spoke yesterday. She reportedly told the Prime Minister that a referendum is a matter of when, not if. So is Boris Johnson able to stop a second independence referendum if the First Minister of Scotland wants to do it?
Boris Johnson can stop it in the sense that it's the UK government that gives the go-ahead or not for a referendum. But I mean, politically, that might get incredibly difficult if pressure was to build for a referendum. So I think This is where we are, Peter. We're essentially London and Edinburgh on a collision course. Why do I say that? Because nobody should underestimate the fervour with which the Scottish National Party believe in independence. But I think the collision, the crash, the impact isn't about to happen next week. Why? It's a bit of a longer burner because the Scottish National Party is fully aware that the polls suggest that people in Scotland don't really want a referendum right now. So the Scottish National Party, keen as they are on a referendum and keen as they are on independence, they don't want to hold another one and lose it. So I think what you're going to see, what everyone around the world will see, is over the next couple of years, you'll see the Scottish National Party building and building the case for independence, building and building a grudge as well against Boris Johnson and the government in London. And you'll also see in that time Boris Johnson and others who remain in favour of the union scrambling to come up with a with a so far elusive argument, particularly for younger Scottish people, as to why the union should continue.
Well, how much has changed since 2014? Is it all just Brexit?
Brexit is, I think, by far and away the biggest part of it, because all of the surveys that have been done of the electorate suggest that essentially what has happened is that the two-thirds of people who voted to remain in the European Union in 2016, they've pretty much broken towards the Scottish National Party. And that is particularly the case amongst younger voters. And there's also a sense, and this is something which the Scottish National Party are trying to encourage, a sense that Scotland feels different about itself than England feels about itself.
I suppose supporters of independence in theory are feeling pretty good about this right now, but in practice, what would it mean to have an independent Scotland?
So they're feeling good about their election victory on Thursday, but they are anxious because they do need to get at some of these difficult questions that people have unionists have posed about independence, such as, well, what would you do about a border? Could anyone really conceive of a border between England and Scotland, something which hasn't really existed since Hadrian's Wall in Roman times? And, you know, what would you do about currency? Would Scotland use the pound? Would it join the euro? Would it be able to join the European Union? I mean, what would it do about without the sort of huge amounts of public spending that come its way via the, if you like, we don't call it that, but the federal government in London? So there would be all sorts of very difficult questions for the nationalists to answer. But of course, what I guess they would say in reply to all the sort of the Brexiteers in London is, well, look, you know, all these questions were raised about Britain leaving the European Union and you didn't listen. So why should we be lectured at by you?
So there's that Boris Johnson is dealing with. It is a pain in his side, no doubt. But he's got some good news because the Conservative Party there is winning elections in parts of England the Labour Party has dominated for decades. Why is that happening, Rob?
Again, it's Brexit. And one way to think about this, and it has a lot of parallels with the United States, not perfect, and in other Western democracies, is, you know, in the past, basically, if you were poor, you voted on the left. If you were richer, you voted on the right. Well, just as that's no longer completely the case in the United States with Republicans and Democrats, that is no longer the case definitively here in the UK.
The BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.